And this evening's talk is going to be on superstition. Superstition. So I'm already going to tell you, it's bad luck to go out from the hall at the beginning of a talk. Superstition. I'm only making a joke. It's not bad luck. Today's talk on superstition. Because even most people these days are still overly superstitious. We worry about things we shouldn't worry about. And we think of all sorts of stuff which gets into our head. So we should do this, we shouldn't do that. If I don't do this, something rotten's going to happen to me. I know something bad is going to happen to me. And a lot of times people run on superstition too much. And some religions run on excess of superstition. And you find all superstition carries with it some fear. And sometimes people use superstition and the fear which it invokes, if you don't do this, something terrible is going to happen, to control people and ruin people's happiness and freedom. And so superstition is a big issue. So what does Buddhism stand with superstition? Have we got superstition as part of our rites? Is it part of the Buddhist tradition? Unfortunately, in many places it is, but that's not real Buddhism. Certainly, that's one of the things which attracted me to sort of this type of teaching. Because it did away with all superstition. Anything which cannot be proved, which you cannot actually show and experience for yourself, you don't have to believe. And it wasn't a religion which was based out of fear, but it was based out of encouragement. There was never any indication, if you don't do this, if you don't do the right thing, if you don't talk to the monks in the correct way, that you're going to go to hell. There was none of that, and that was actually very, very beautiful to see that. You can question everything. And these days, I keep on making the statement in brief that really that the type of teachings which you hear here, sort of the, we hope is make as representative, as accurate as we possibly can to the authentic Buddhist teachings, is a religion without superstition. It's a religion which will always bend its faith to fit the facts, and never the other way around, never bending the facts to fit the faith. So superstition doesn't have a part of this. But nevertheless, you find, as a religion like Buddhism gets into people's cultures, they always tend to add these superstitious things onto it. And I want to sort of deal with a few of those things to begin with. Even here I see that some of you are wearing these Buddha medallions. And some people wear not just one, but 2, 3, 4, 5, 10, 20. And they think it can bring you good luck. But if you carry too many Buddha medallions around your neck, it doesn't give you good luck. It gives you neck ache. And it's quite obvious why all that weight around you. And also, it also brings you sort of a lack of money, because some of those Buddha medallions cost a lot of money. And that was one of the things which was added onto Buddhism in a country like Thailand, where I grew up. And my goodness, sometimes you see these Thai Buddhists with hundreds of medallions around their neck. And what are you doing that for? And I read this story, which is a great story in the newspapers, a true story. Some of these Buddha medallions, you can actually buy them for lots of money. And this Thai general had one which was worth $500,000. This is no joke, they cost that much. He bought it, $500,000. Because this medallion was going to stop bullets. So... And that's very important for a soldier. So he was in his mess, you know, in some sort of army camp somewhere outside of Bangkok. And he was just bragging about this medallion he just bought for $500,000 US and how it would protect him from bullets. And he said, "If you don't believe me," he said to the major, "take my gun and shoot me." And the major took that as an order. So he took his gun and pulled the trigger. You know what happened? It's amazing. It killed him. And that's why I got into the newspapers. This general died, because he believed in this $500,000 sort of trinket. And of course, he was dead, so he couldn't ask for his money back anymore. But why do people do that? Now, we have this superstition which people have, and that sometimes ruins the reputation of real religion. And sometimes we have all this chanting which people want to hear. And I've already sort of told how stupid Thailand is somewhere. For those of you who haven't heard this story, this is true Buddhism. My teacher, Ajahn Chah, he would never give out medallions. You know, he was one of those monks. If you saw a little medallion with Ajahn Chah's photo on it, he would find out who printed it, and he would go there and confiscate them all. You have no permission. I don't agree with this. But what happened? One day, one of his disciples came to see him and said, "Look, I need a medallion from you. I've been drafted into the army. It's dangerous." Even though there were no wars on, there were very many skirmishes on the borders between the communist countries and even with Burma as well. He said, "I'm afraid of getting shot. I need one of these medallions. I know you can do it. You're a holy monk. Give me a Buddha to put around my neck to protect me from bullets." And Ajahn Chah kept saying, "No, no, no, we can't do that. Please, please, please. No, no, no. Ajahn Chah, you've been teaching us about gratitude. I've been feeding you, looking after you for such a long time. The least you can do is give me a Buddha to put around my neck to protect me from bullets." So in the end, Ajahn Chah gave in. "Okay, it's true what you say. Gratitude is important. You have given so much food to the monks, your donations to the temple. I think, fair enough, you know, that out of gratitude, I can give you a Buddha to put around your neck, which will actually protect you from bullets." "Great," he said. "Where is it?" He said, "It's a big Buddha statue like that one in the back. You put that around your neck, I guarantee it will take you from bullets." "And that's the only one which I can guarantee will protect you from bullets as well. Hide behind that and you'll be safe." Now that is what we mean about trying to overcome people's stupid superstitions. Because when they don't understand what truth is and they have these superstitions, what happens to you? That you have a medallion around your neck, that's the thing, that's all that really matters, and you get yourself into big trouble. Or you get some chanting done by the monks and you think, "Oh, now I've got the chanting done, I don't need to care about my health. The monks have chanted for me today, I can break the speed limit because the speed cameras won't work because I've got some chanting for my Ajahn Brahm." Please don't think like that, because this is not what Buddhism is all about. The origin story of Buddhism was as a man sitting under a tree, becoming enlightened. You know what that tree was called? The Bodhi tree, the enlightenment tree, the wisdom tree. Sometimes in, especially evangelical Christianity, that they have a similar origin story, Adam and Eve. Only this time they ate the fruit from that tree and they called it original sin. Can you see the difference there? No, one was the knowledge tree was important. Eat it, take it, become wise, understand it for yourself. So Buddhism, because it was even had the origin story, which was very, very important to understand its meanings and its implications, we want people to understand. And a lot of superstition is just, you know, blindness, not allowing people to investigate and find out for themselves, and just believing without really testing it out. And if we have that blind belief, it can sort of cause a lot of psychological problems to human beings and even physical wars simply because of our superstitions. So I was talking about even chanting. You know, one of the things which the Buddha said, it's a great teaching, and sometimes I get into trouble for teaching it, but it's straight from the word of the Buddha. When somebody once asked him, "Now, when somebody dies, if we chant for them, does it really affect the person?" And the Buddha said, "Imagine this, you take a pot of oil." It was actually ghee, but ghee is a type of oil. "You take a clay pot of oil, you take it to some sort of lake or pond, and you break it over that lake. Then, what would happen? The clay heavy part would go to the bottom, and the oil would float to the surface. Then," said the Buddha, "suppose that some monk went to the side of that lake and started praying or doing some chanting. Do you think because of that chanting that the shards of clay will float to the surface and the oil will go down to the bottom? Of course not. It's in just the same way that beings will go according to their karma when they die. And for so often, all the chanting in the world just won't affect that. Maybe if you're just in between, you know, you've got some good karma, some bad karma, and it's maybe maybe we can give a little nudge. But that's all that chanting can do, just a nudge. A lot of the time it's already settled, so it's a bit too late. It's just the same way as that woman who came to see us many, many years ago. This was actually my predecessor, Ajahn Chakra. But I think I was involved in this as well, because she came here one day because she was doing her end of the year examinations in UWA, and she wanted some chanting so that she'd have success in her examinations. And that's very often that we know when many young people come to our monastery in Serpentine, they go and see Sister Wayama in Gijiganup. We know that must be just exam week. Why do you do that? Because this lady came there, she wanted some chanting, so we did some chanting for her anyway. We're kind monks. But afterwards, we never saw her again. And we wonder what happened to her. So we saw one of her friends. Where's she gone? Has she gone back overseas or something? He said, no. She hasn't gone overseas. She's really bad-mouthing this monastery and temple. She's saying, you monks are terrible. You're hopeless. You don't know anything about Buddhism because our chanting didn't work. She failed. Now, that's a sad story. Obviously, it's nothing to do with the chanting. It's because she never did her work. But because she believed superstitiously that chanting is all you need, she was heedless. She never did her work. And that's the danger of superstitions. If we just believe that, okay, it doesn't really matter, that when we die, the monks will do the chanting for us, therefore I don't need to sort of be a good person, then of course, you know, you're in big trouble when the exam at the end of life comes. And you know what rebirth you get. So you have to be very, very careful. If you really want to be protected from bullets, then don't join the army. If you really want to be protected from bad luck, then do lots of good karma. And if you really want to be protected, you know, from misfortune, then be a kind and generous person. Now, this is not superstition. You can see the justice in this, the cause and effect, and it makes a lot of sense. But unfortunately, that people just sometimes think, no, they just want some easy way, and they're just too gullible. And sometimes we think all we need to do is just to go to some sort of church and do some praying. If as long as I go to the temple every week, then when I die, then I'll be happy. It's not just coming to the temple. It's not just doing the ceremonies. It's much more than that. And it's actually who you are. You come to this temple, you know, to this Friday evening here. Why do you come here for? It's not just to bow to the Buddha and light some incense and go home again afterwards thinking you're pure. That doesn't make you pure. In the same way that in the time of the Buddha, there was this big idea, superstition, and it's still here today, that if you bathe in the river Ganges, then all your sins are washed away. That was in the time of the Buddha. And when people asked the Buddha that, he said, look, if that was the case, and this is the Buddha's statement, he said, then all the fish who swim in the Ganges would now be enlightened and holy, because they bathe 24 hours a day. So even the Buddha had a sense of humour. And it's obvious, isn't it? But sometimes that we don't understand this and we're superstitious, we don't think it out for ourselves, we don't gather the evidence, and sometimes, even today, you see that many, many people go to the Ganges at a certain time of year and they want to bathe away their sins or their bad karma. Does that really make sense to you? But does it also make sense? You just go to a priest or something and just give an offering and please may you forgive me. Or you ask some Jesus Christ or something, please forgive my sins. Superstition. What that does, it means you don't take responsibility for yourself and for your life and for your goodness and for your virtue. That's the only thing we can do. If we don't do that, and we pass the buck by some superstitious idea which we never really check out, it means that a lot of times that we create misery for ourselves and a lot of problems for other people. There's too much superstition. You know, in this world. I was just reading the other day, a couple of days ago, I've just been reading Richard Dawkins' book about the God delusion. And one of the things there he was saying that the idea that if an Islamic martyr blows themselves up, they'll go to heaven and they'll have 72 black-eyed virgins. And he said, actually, that's a wrong translation. What he, this guy who's an Islamic scholar or Arabic scholar or something, was saying, it means they'll get 72 clear white raisins. That's what it said anyway. So, you know, raisins, sultanas, you know, these little dried grapes. Makes things a lot different, doesn't it? But, I mean, those superstitions, they motivate people. And this is no joke, because that does motivate people to actually blow themselves up in front of other people and cause a huge amount of problem and trouble in this world. Superstitions are no laughing matter. So what we have to do as a rational people, investigative people, we have to sit under the Bodhi tree. Not literally, but metaphorically. To sit under wisdom. To literally, no, not so much sit, but stand, which is understand. Understand what's going on and why, and to use one's powers of reasoning and experience and questioning to find out what is truly going on. When one does that, a lot of the superstitions of life just disappear. Yeah, chanting may be useful to give you some confidence in the same way that if a football team is playing, so the chanting from the crowds. That's where I first learnt my chanting, at a football club in London, on the terraces, chanting for my football team. It does encourage the football team. You know, it does lift their spirits, and chanting does that. It can lift the spirits. But even much better than chanting, in the time of the Buddha, when the monks would go and visit somebody at their deathbed, they wouldn't do chanting. They'd just teach. They'd give an understanding of what is the process of death, what's happening and why. A lot of the chanting, which we even do now, is actually just old teachings. It's as if, you know, the Buddha was at born in Perth in 2007, and he gave a talk one evening here. And it was a nice talk, and somebody remembered it. And after a while, they started chanting it. And then the chant became sort of somehow powerful. It was like a meaning in the original, just like a talk here. But years and years later, they just do the chant. They stay the outside without understanding what the real meaning is. Like this afternoon, we did a marriage ceremony, which is why I was a bit late. And at the marriage ceremony, we're just joking. What chanting should we do? And one of the monks said, let's do the death chanting, the funeral chanting. They won't know, even though it's a wedding. We could have done a funeral chanting and no one would have known, because they don't understand what we're chanting. It all sounds the same to them. And actually, that was the bride's brother. I won't say who it is, but many of you know who he is. But why do you listen to these chants? But sometimes superstition, I can use it in my favour. I remember this time one day when I was visiting my mother in London. And it was about the time for the morning meal. And you may know, when monks only eat one meal a day, that morning meal is important. That's got precedence. So when the doorbell rang of her apartment, I went to answer it. Said, Mum, you carry on with the meal. I'll answer the door. I'll deal with this. So when I answered the door, it was a gypsy lady. Now, to give you some background, these gypsy ladies in sort of London, they go around selling little trinkets. Now, that's how they make their money. And so when they were coming, like little, even little pieces of heather or worthless stuff, for a considerable amount of money. And so when they knocked on the door, I said, do you want to buy some gypsy heather for good luck? I said, no, thank you. I was very polite. But then she said, if you don't buy my gypsy heather, I'll put a curse on you. That's what they do actually to get the money. And most people are so superstitious. You know, they don't know. Maybe it can happen, maybe it can't happen. So they give them a couple of pounds. And that's where they make this money. I wasn't going to stand for that. You know, this superstitious nonsense. So I stood up in my robes, had my robes on, said, don't you know who I am? I'm a Buddhist monk of many, many years. My curses are far stronger than yours. And I shouldn't have said that, but that lady ran. She was so afraid. I'm a bit cheeky sometimes and naughty, but I did enjoy that, I must admit. And it's a complete superstition. Monks, even if we did have curses, we wouldn't curse anybody. That's not in our spirit. That's not loving kindness. But certainly, she believed I could, and she was so superstitious, she ran. So there's some advantages of being a monk in his brown robes. Especially in the old days when people thought that, you know, you were kung fu experts. That really saved me a few times when I was in London walking past these gang of, you know, kids. Because sometimes they can be very mean, these gangs. And sometimes they looked at me and they didn't really know whether I knew all these tricks, so they let me go past. But there's too much superstition in this world, causes a lot of trouble. And of course, one of the biggest things of superstition is what's going to happen to you after you die. And because there is a lack of understanding and knowledge there, because most of you haven't got a clue what's going to happen to you after you die. Some people who've done good meditation can know from personal experience. Some people may have had out-of-the-body experiences can know, because, you know, you've died temporarily. But most of you, you don't know what's going to happen to you after you die. And many, many religions, many, many people, they exploit that lack of knowledge. And in its place, they put superstition. And as they to try and force that superstition on you, there's all sorts of fears involved. And it's because that lack of knowledge, and sometimes trying to control people through fear, that we get these terrible superstitions. What happens to you after you die? Sometimes people say you can go up to heaven or you can go down to hell. When you start to point that out, people get a bit concerned. I'm going to go to heaven or I'm going to go to hell. You start thinking to yourself, which one do I deserve to go to? And because of the guilt trips of many people in the West, you already think that there's a good probability I might go down to hell. Are you really pure enough to go up to heaven? Anyone here? Well, what's going to happen to you then? And people say, ah! One of the problems is superstitious people normally die very terrible deaths. And I've been talking to many, many doctors and nurses over the years. And I'm not saying this just to make people Buddhists. But I think this is anecdotal evidence that Buddhists die more peacefully than many other people. I think Buddhists and maybe atheists, secularists, they die quite peacefully. The ones who die in terror are those who believe superstitiously in an eternal heaven or an eternal hell. A lot of the time because there's always a few bad things they've done. And those few bad things which they focus on think that I don't deserve to go to heaven. So there's only one place I'm going to go to. There's enough doubt there. For those of you who've done examinations or gone to interviews for new jobs, do you feel nervous? This is the mother of all interviews when you die. It's the biggest exam you'll ever take if you follow that superstitious idea. This is not just for a job, just for a few weeks or for a few years. According to some religions, this is for eternity. Eternal happiness or eternal hellfire. Now that's pretty scary. And that will scare the pants or the skirts or whatever, or the sabongs, that's what we wear, of anybody if you really believe that. And that's why that people actually are afraid of death, mostly. Now, what would happen if we can somehow break that superstition down? If we can break that superstition down, at least we'll have some confidence of what's going to happen. First of all, does that really make sense to you? That because of what you've done, you've only got two choices. Now, eternal pleasure and happiness, or eternal sort of pain and torment. Even when I first read that as a kid, I thought that is unjust, unfair. It can't be that way. There is no one who deserves sort of eternal hell. And how many people deserve eternal happiness as well? You're not good enough for eternal happiness. And anyway, when you think about it, eternal happiness, don't be superstitious. How can that happen? What one does is one uses one's faculties of understanding, reason, wisdom in this life to understand, you know, what is happiness anyway? What is unhappiness? There is this old story, and this is great Buddhist wisdom, because it brings things down from superstition down into ordinary daily life. Many of you have heard the story before, but it's a great story about the old samurai warrior who too wanted to know, and what do really Buddhists think about heaven and hell? Is there a heaven? Is there a hell? No, really? And he'd gone around to many, many people, and no one could give him a good answer. And maybe the same with you. Maybe you've gone to many sort of temples, many talks, asked many people, and it's sort of satisfying, but you can't really get a straight answer, which really satisfies you and answers the question once and for all. So this samurai eventually found this old monk and said, "Old monk, look, this is my question. You know, I've gone around asking so many people this, I'm almost fed up to ask it again, but is there a heaven? Is there a hell? Now, if you know this and really know it, say so. But if you don't know it, don't waste my time. Just say, I don't know. Okay?" And the monk looked up at the samurai warrior and said, you're too stupid to understand." And the samurai said, "What do you just call me, stupid? I'm not stupid. I'm a samurai warrior." These samurai warriors have to go through an enormous amount of training. And it's not just the martial arts, it's a lot of virtuous training and training in meditation. He said, "I'm not stupid, I'm a samurai warrior." And the monk looked up at him, "You, a samurai, don't give me that, you fool, you're just a country bumpkin, that's all." And the samurai said, "That's twice you've insulted me." And he took hold of his sword. "If you insult me one more time, monk, I don't care who you are, I'll cut off your head just with one swipe of my sword." "With that stupid old rusty piece of iron, you couldn't even slice of bread with that." And that was enough. The samurai insulted three times was incensed, and he got out his sword and was about to smite the monk's head off when the monk looked right into his eyes and said, "Samurai, that's hell." And I keep on saying that was pushing his luck, but it worked. Maybe if it didn't work, he wouldn't be able to tell the story. But the samurai understood that anger was what hell is like. At last he got an answer, which wasn't anything to do with superstition. The monk wasn't saying, "It says in my scriptures." Because that really offended me a lot. When people say, "It says in the books." That's not what I asked you, what's in the books. I asked you. Now, you're supposed to be a Christian, you're supposed to be a Buddhist, you're supposed to be a teacher. I'm not saying, I can read the books myself. You, is there a heaven, is there a hell? Explain. I'm not asking the books, I'm asking the person. And at last he actually got a proper answer. He could understand what hell was. And he was so impressed, he put aside his sword and he bowed to that monk. That's what you do in Asia, out of respect. It's not asking for favours, it's an act of thank you so much. And when the monk looked him in again and saw his eyes were watering out of respect and gratitude, and the monk said to him very softly, "And samurai, now this is heaven." That gratitude and respect, that's what heaven is like. Now that's a beautiful saying, a beautiful story, because that almost encapsulates what this Buddhism is all about. Bringing these sort of very difficult to understand but important teachings back to earth, into your own personal experience, because that's what heaven and hell are like. And you can imagine that if a consciousness did persist after life, that if you actually thought anger, and that's what your character was, then you'd make an angry world. That's what happens to hell. You make the hell. And it's something which you can see in this life, how people make hells in their life. You create it. That's why I couldn't understand why, when I was a young kid, you used to go out to the pub with your mates. We always went out to nice, calm, quiet pubs. But some people would always go to these pubs where every Friday night there was a fight. So why do people do that for? Because they like it. They want to have that. They create that. Why is it that people sometimes have relationships which don't work? Do you create that? You ask any psychologist and say, yep. You asked for it. You wanted it. You didn't want to be happy. It's the guilt which gives the clue to what hell is. So this doesn't need to be a superstition anymore. You can actually see in your life that when you've done something wrong, and we've all done things wrong in our life, sometimes the way we look at that error, we amplify it out of all proportions, we get into guilt trips, we think we're awful, we think we don't deserve to be happy. And this is what we mean by creating our hell. And if that happens to you when you die, with that guilt, with that lack of forgiveness, with a lack of saying, I'm a human being, let it go. Then, of course, if that's what's preoccupying your mind when you die, you don't deserve to be happy. So, of course, you won't allow yourself to be happy. You will create a hell for yourself. That's why one of the greatest insights which I got from Buddhism was this beautiful forgiveness. And this is not superstition. You don't have to ask anyone else to forgive you. In fact, if you ask someone else to forgive you, it doesn't work. Even if you ask a Jesus to forgive you, or a Buddha to forgive you, what right has that person got to forgive you? All they can do, or even a monk can do, is actually to encourage you to forgive yourself. That's the only person who can let go of the past, yourself. And it's a beautiful thing to be able to see this in action. When somebody has done something in the past, and we've all done silly, stupid things in the past. This silly, I think I gave this simile over in Singapore about me selling encyclopedias. Was that here or was that in Singapore? Anyone remember that one here, recent weeks? I give so many talks, and I don't know where I've given the last talk. Tomorrow I'm going to Malaysia early in the morning to give a talk in Malaysia. So I give so many talks, I don't know which story I've told where. So this was the story of when I was a young student, in order to try and pay my way, you know, through the university system, you know, just actually to pay my bills, the university fees were all paid for. I got all these stupid jobs, and one of them was selling encyclopedias door to door, the worst possible job you can ever have, but I was desperate. And the worst thing about that job, it was like children's encyclopedias. The worst possible thing about that job was that I sold one. And as soon as I sold one, I felt so guilty. Because it was all lies. You know, you're learning how to make these parents feel just as if they were next to pedophiles if they didn't actually get this book for their children. They were abusing their children's future. They didn't love them if they didn't get this incredible asset to their future education. And of course, you know, after a while, you got good at sort of that type of lying stuff. And eventually, I sold this children's computer to this young family. And, you know, they were just obviously just starting out in life, and they had their first child. And they were just really, really soft and caring. And they said, oh, yeah, perhaps we should get this for our little child. And so I got my first commission. But I had sleepless nights over that. I thought, I sold this stupid encyclopedia to these poor people. Who knows? They probably won't be able to afford it. They may not be able to have their lunch or pay their mortgage. Oh, what have I done? I felt terrible about that. I felt guilty. And you know how I actually let go of that guilt when I was a monk? But you know how I fully let go of that guilt? Was when I told a story here about 15 years ago. And after telling the story, afterwards, you know when people come up to talk to me. So someone came up to me and he said, that was an amazing story you just said. It's too much of a coincidence, but who knows. But when I was growing up in England, this young student came to our house. And they sold my parents this children's encyclopedia. And I loved that encyclopedia. Oh, that was one of my favorite books. That created so much happiness for me. When I realised that, it was probably unlikely it was the same person, but who knows, that I thought I'd done some terrible, terrible, terrible deed. And she told me that it could may have been a wonderful thing which happened. So sometimes, whenever we've done something, we don't know the full consequences, how it worked out in the future. What would have happened if we'd taken the other choice? We can't know that. Sometimes what you did probably was the best. So why do we feel guilty about that? Superstition. That's why we feel guilty. We've been taught that guilt is a proper response. These days, and here I teach a lot, we've got a car sticker for it, AFL code. If you don't know what the AFL code is, go and get the sticker from the library. Acknowledge, forgive, learn. So acknowledge what you've done. I'm not saying sort of say it's a bad thing or a good thing. Acknowledge it. This is the act which I've done. That forgive it means, you know, you're a human being. We all do things. Sometimes we make mistakes. Sometimes we do wonderful things. So you're just like anybody else in this world. So you forgive it. And then you learn from it. Make sure you don't get into that situation again. And that's all you need to do. And if you do things like that, any psychologist knows, you know it in your own experience, it's called growth in spirituality. It actually works. It means you can let go of the pain of the past and you're not stopping yourself being happy. You are free to enjoy your life and to be a better person in this world. People who carry around the past out of superstition think you have to, and carry around their guilt, they create a lot of pain for themselves, and even worse, a lot of trouble for others. They can't form relationships. Sometimes they have great psychological problems. They get into drink and drugs simply because they're trying to escape. From who? Escaping from themselves. So that's one of the worst superstitions in our world, the guilt, which is all coming from punishment as well. Thinking if you've done something wrong, you have to be punished. And religions like Buddha say punishment hasn't got a part in it. Why are you punishing somebody for making a mistake? That does not help. As a kid, if ever I made a mistake and got punished, the only thing I learned from that is not to get caught next time. If you get done by the speed camera and you get a fine, what do you learn from that? Not to speed, no, to find out where the speed cameras are so you know they're not over here. I can speed over here, I don't speed over there. Too much of our time, punishment, just teaches us the wrong thing. And this is the problem with our superstitious idea of punishment. And it was wonderful to actually to read Buddhism and to actually to be in traditional Buddhist countries and especially places where, like in Northeast Thailand, where he was actually lived. You never saw Ajahn Chah punishing anybody. And some of those monks would do stupid things. I remember him once talking about the naughtiest novice. He's always like talking about these novice monks. He said the naughtiest novice, I remember him talking, he was just laughing all over. He said, this is what he's done. This is an aside. This naughtiest novice, there was this old monk who was always really, really sleepy. So he was sleeping in the afternoon. So when he slept so deeply and nothing would wake him up. So the novice got one of these jackfruit seeds. Now, jackfruit seeds are about this big. And I'm going to tell you this because Ajahn Chah told me this. He lifted up the back of his sarong and tried to put it in his anus. You know, so he'd be constipated. This was a naughty novice. And he tried to get it in, but it was just couldn't get it in. So he tried a couple of times. So you can imagine sort of, you know, what stuff which was smeared on it. So the novice started chewing it to make it soft enough to actually push it in. And imagine it finally managed it. So this poor old monk, when he woke up, oh, I can't go to the toilet, I can't go to the toilet. That was like a naughty novice. So what would you do to a naughty novice like that? And punishment is not the way. It doesn't teach you anything. How many times have you been punished? didn't really, what did it teach you? Sometimes it taught you to silence. Sometimes it just taught you to try and escape next time. Sometimes it just confused you that the person punishing you was supposed to be someone you loved. They're supposed to love you. What's going on? Acknowledge, forgive, learn is by far the better way, where we actually reward the positive in another person. So, the superstition which sometimes is rammed into us, you've done a bad thing, it's evil, you're going to get punished by some sort of God, or even by karma in the future. What karma does, you have a chance, you're always making karma. It's the great thing about karma, it's not punishment, because karma is always what you do in every moment. It means you can always bend it this way, you can bend it that way, you can always do something about it yourself. One of the things you can do is to forgive. It's a wonderful thing to actually to know. I can forgive myself. And asking someone else to forgive you, sometimes it's nice if you've hurt someone else and ask forgiveness, but they give you forgiveness, but it still doesn't solve the problem. You have to forgive yourself. And that's fundamental. And this is not superstition anymore, because you can feel this yourself, you can try it yourself, and my goodness, it works. And people love it so much when, not that they come here and Ajahn Brahm forgives you, or the other monks forgive you, or Sister Ajahn Wayama forgives you, or some big god in the sky forgives you. When you do it yourself, you know, you can do it yourself. It's allowable. It can be done, and it's a wonderful thing to do. That gives you freedom and peace. Then you're less likely to repeat the mistakes. You've learned from them, and you just leave it behind. You go forward, rather than always being caught, dragged, and not allowed to go forward, because you're always carrying this huge weight of the past with you. The superstitions which we have about guilt and punishment, again, all come with this idea of what's going to happen to us later in the future. It's important to understand what happens to you after you die. You know, the superstitions about life after death are sometimes real crazy. And so we have to find out, is there life after death? Is there not life after death? Is there reincarnation? What's going to happen? Sometimes it's just passing about to say, well, I'll wait and see what happens after I die. Because sometimes that's a bit too late. Now, fortunately, you don't have to do that. Now, there is ways and means of finding out for yourself. And one of those ways and means is actually finding out through meditation. If there is something which goes on after death, what actually is it? When you understand what this thing we call the mind is, you know, the heart of things, you know, what's really driving you? In my book, Mindfulness, Bliss and Beyond, I gave a simile of the emperor with the five pieces of clothing on. It's a powerful simile which I only usually teach during retreats. Imagine there's an emperor. And this emperor is a very, very, very powerful being. And, you know, it affects you what this emperor does. This emperor is clothed. He's got boots, or it's got boots, you don't know if it's a he or she, it's got boots which cover its feet and go right up to its thighs. It's got trousers which cover the top of its boots and go halfway up its waist. It's got a jacket which covers the top of its trousers, go to the elbows and right up to the neck. And it's got these gloves which cover all the hands and go halfway up the arm. And last, it's got a helmet. And this helmet just covers the whole of the face and halfway down the, you know, overlaps the tunic. So the five pieces of clothing completely cover this emperor. So much so you don't know who this emperor is. Whether it's male or female, whether it's old or young, whether it's African, Caucasian, Chinese or what. And this is like the mind. This mind, this emperor within you, it's covered with the five senses of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, and touching. And that's why sometimes we don't know what this mind actually is. In a Buddhist way, we want to try and unclothe the emperor. Take off these five senses of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, and touching to get to this sixth sense, the mind. Always the sixth sense was called the mind in Buddhism from the very earliest of times. There's always six senses. And as I mentioned, and other talks, even in ancient Greek philosophy, there was always six senses as well. If you read Aristotle, always the six senses, the mind was there as well. And Aristotle called the mind the common sense because it was common to all the other senses. What you see, what you hear, smell, taste, touch, the mind also knows. That's why it was Aristotle. He was the one who coined the term common sense. And somehow, in 2,000 years of history in the West, we've not only lost our common sense, we've also lost our mind. We've only got five senses left now. And that's a big reason for some of the problems we have. We want to find out what this mind actually is, because you know, if something is going to last after death, it's not the five senses or the body. We all know the body's not going to last. So, what is this mind? We have to take off the five senses. And that's what the job of meditation is. You sit still, close your eyes so you don't see, make yourself so still you don't hear, you don't smell, taste, even your body disappears. People who get into those deep meditations so they just know what the mind is, when you know what it is, then you have an understanding of what happens to you after you die. And this is no longer superstition. This is direct personal experience. One of the first things which happens when you get into this deep meditation, you see this beautiful light which we call nimitta. If you want to find out more about that, there's a whole book I wrote about this, Mindfulness, Bliss and Beyond, available in the library, $25, special offer this weekend, $24.99. But this is actually, you see this beautiful light. For those of you who've had out-of-the-body experiences or heard other people having out-of-the-body experiences or seeing on the TV, what do people do when they die? They go towards the light. That's exactly the same light which you see in meditation when you get to that stage. The stage we call it nimitta. It's this beautiful light. I've said in many retreats that when you experience this stage, you are practicing dying. You're learning what it's like. Because that light usually only comes up and is strong when your seeing has disappeared, when you can't hear anything, you can't feel your body. The five senses have disappeared. You've unclothed the emperor, the mind. You see what it is for the first time. It appears as a light so often to people. It's not a light, but that's just how we interpret it. It's a pure mind object. You're seeing the mind, understanding it. The great thing with this is that you know from that time, from that moment on, you should know, it's pretty clear to you, you've got the evidence that when your body dies, I mean real death, you know, when you cark it, when you call the funeral directors, when the body dies, this is exactly what happens. Five senses have stopped, body's not working anymore. Going towards that light, you're with the mind. That mind is what survives the death. Later on, when you investigate that mind, for those of you who have read the books, that mind is not a solid thing. It just keeps on changing, just like this body keeps on changing. So it's not an entity, but a process. When you understand that, you understand just what happens after death. And it's very interesting because when you first see that nimitta, that beautiful light in your meditation, sometimes it's not nice. It's a little bit dirty. It's not bright and powerful. When people see this, they ask me, what's going on? I say, because you are not pure. You're a bit dirty. What have you been thinking the last few hours? I mean, not sort of being critical here. This is just you're seeing your mind as it actually is. Not as you want it to be. Denial and wishful thinking have got no place here. You're seeing what you've been doing. And this is why, in my experience as a teacher, when people I've known for a long time, they are truly good people. They really are virtuous people. They volunteered for the Buddhist Society of West Australia Committee. They've been generous. They've been keeping their five precepts. They've, you know, been faithful to their partners. You know, they sort of been kind. They haven't been backbiting. They haven't shown all this jealousy and gossip, which people do. Gossip's all right, as long as you tell the nice things about other people. they're really good people. And because I've been around a long time, I know a lot of you, I know who the really nice people, good people are. And all the time, these people, when they get to that stage of meditation, their light in their mind is just so brilliant and beautiful. Obviously, because they're bright and beautiful people. Now, that's a very important understanding to have, because that's what you'll experience when you die. You'll experience the beauty or the lack of beauty of your own mind. And that's what will take you into a heaven realm or into a lesser realm. You can see the process happening. You don't have to have great psychic powers. You can actually see it for yourself. If you don't believe that, when you get into these deep meditations, you can even ask yourself, and this is, I've been trying this for a long time with my disciples, and once they get into deep meditation, I ask them to make the resolution, what's my earliest memory? What's my earliest memory? It only works when you're at that type of stage, sort of nimitta stage or after a jhana. Because when you ask that question, these images arise in your mind straight away. These are early life memories. If you read my book here, it's the only thing, one which I can tell you, because I'm not allowed to sort of say too much about psychic powers and stuff. The only ones which I can tell you is when I first did this and got this smell in my nose. And this is not imagination anymore. You're smelling it as if it's right here in front of you. It's a real smell. My eyes closed. And I recognized it straight away. It was the smell of my baby's pram. And immediately, I was back in my pram. A re-experience, even though I was sitting meditation. I think this first happened over in, when I'd left Thailand, coming to Perth. You were back in your baby's pram. And with that experience, you could, your eyes were closed, you could see everything clearly as if you were, had your eyes open. There I could see my baby's pram and all the old toys which I used to have in it. And I could play around in there. It was a vision from the past. As I say in the book, when you have these experiences, one of their hallmarks is this absolute certainty that was you. In the same way, there's absolute certainty it's you right here looking at me or hearing this talk. The same degree of certainty. Weird, but true. Then you can ask yourself, earlier, please. Or earlier, please. And people then actually get the life in the mother's womb very often. Or they get an earlier time, another place, another time, another body. You actually remember yourself in a previous life. So these are things which, you know, take away all your superstitions. Because this is real positive experience. But this is my experience. I can't actually, you can't believe me. Please don't believe me. Because that's more superstition, taking it on granted for somebody, from somebody else. You have to find, even though the Buddha kept on saying about that, even though there's books by people like Professor Ian Stevenson, who researched all of this and did a lot of good work trying to present the evidence for reincarnation or rebirth. Once you see it for yourself, you don't need those books anymore because you know for yourself. And that's something you can do in this life. You don't have to wait until you die when it's a bit late if you're wrong. And that's one of the wonderful things where we can cut through all this superstition. And imagine if you had that knowledge for yourself, that own personal knowledge that you've lived before. And you understand why rebirth happens and how the karma works. Wouldn't that really sort of cut away all this superstition and all this doubt and all understanding of what I should do in this life and how I should act and what should happen? Wouldn't it cut away your fear of death and understanding what happens to other people when they die and worrying about short lives or long lives or what the meaning of life truly is when you understand just you keep going round and round, learning each time, hopefully. Sometimes we regress as well. It's a wonderful thing to be able to know for yourself. You can do this. It's there for you if you really want to. It's a wonderful thing to know. And it cuts away the stupid superstitions and say, my religion is right. If you don't believe me, I'll cut your head off. Well, my religion is right. So please be converted. Otherwise, you know, you're going to sort of upset me. Some of these superstitions really sort of create an enormous amount of pain in people's lives. People are actually telling me in places like Singapore and Malaysia, where I go very often, sometimes some of the Buddhists, on their deathbed, they may have one child who's been converted by one of these born-again Christian groups. And they bring their parcel and all their friends around to try and convert their grandfather on their deathbed. Because this is the last chance to get their grandfather to heaven, otherwise he's going to burn in hell forever and ever and ever. Sure, they're sincere. Just like Hitler was sincere. He thought he was doing the right thing too. Sincerity is no guarantee of morality. So be careful of sincerity. You can go either way. And so a lot of times people are asking me, what should we do if that ever happens to us? Because they may have some distant relative, a second cousin twice removed, who's an evangelical and come and bother them at their deathbed. I say it's an easy thing to do. When they come around and they try and convert you, just convert to being a Christian. It's easy, and then they go away. And after they've gone away, convert back to being a Buddhist. You can convert one, we can convert the other way. What's the problem? There's a very practical solution. That's the only way to get rid of them. But you can see the harm which superstition gives in this world. If you really believe that, that if you only go to my church and believe my religion and my way, that's the only way you can have everlasting life. And other than that, you're going to go to hell, you're going to burn, you're going to be tortured. What type of psychological pressure does that give on a person? What sort of pain does that give to loved ones? If anything is evil, that's evil in this world, because it creates so much suffering. And you can't argue and sort of present evidence, even though the evidence is so strong. The only way is to find it out for yourself. So you have this inner understanding of what truth is. So you don't have to be superstitious anymore. You don't have to look in the horoscopes to see whether this is going to be a good day or a bad day. Any day you go to a temple, any day you're kind, any day you're generous, any day you've got compassion in your heart, that's a good day. So please, don't be superstitious. Don't waste all your money on medallions or strings or chanting or holy water. You know what Ajahn Chah, I think I told that story when this general asked for holy water. Ajahn Chah would very rarely give holy water. And one day, Ajahn Chah was a joker, but sometimes I thought he'd really go too far, because this day this general came up to him, and I was there at his hut. So, you hang around, because it's great entertainment sometimes, to see what Ajahn Chah was going to do next. And this major general, that now again, the generals are in power in Thailand. This was a time when they were always in power. They had, I think, a lay government, but the generals were the power behind the scenes. And so this big major general came up to see Ajahn Chah in Ubon to ask for some holy water. I said, I haven't got any holy water. He said, oh, please, Ajahn Chah Lung Po, they called it. Please, some holy water. So bow down. Okay, bow down. And Ajahn Chah, he spelt all this saliva in his general's head and rubbed it in. And I thought, my goodness, you've gone too far this time, Ajahn Chah. You really have. And this general brought it. He said, oh, sadhu, 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 I've got real holy water. From the... How stupid could you be? That's what he did. So you may laugh at that superstition, but what superstitions have you got? Whether it's Friday the 13th, do you think, oh, I better not travel on that day? I love Friday the 13th, because that's the day I try and get flights on Friday the 13th, because I know how I have more leg room in economy class. Thank goodness for other people's stupid superstitions. So please, don't be superstitious. Sit under the Bodhi tree of wisdom. Find out for yourselves. If there's anything there which you have any superstitions about Buddhism, whether it's this chanting. I was actually going to sort of slam the Sri Lankan tradition as well. I slammed the Buddhist tradition, the Thai tradition enough. Sometimes they have this all-night pirit chanting in Sri Lanka, where they have three suttas, three old teachings of the Buddha, which sometimes we chant. It takes us about 10 minutes to chant. But they chant it for all night. I couldn't believe it the first time I heard it. Now, usually, for example, like the Metta Sutta, Karaniyamatta Kusalena, That's the first compound. When the Sri Lanka monks chant at one of these all-night ceremonies, this is what they do. Listen. I won't go any further, but it takes about 2 minutes for the first syllable. Now, you're laughing there, but many Sri Lankans here, you've seen that, and you probably tried to organise that yourself. Now, it's great that sort of when Buddhism comes to a Western country, sometimes, and you know, I've got enough clout now to be able to criticise like that, and without getting into too much trouble. I still get into trouble, but who cares? Because what it's done, it's a superstition. And sort of modern people are not going to handle that at all. They're going to reject Buddhism as another superstition, superstitious religion. When it's got something much more powerful than that, much more true and beautiful than that. So somehow we have to take away some of those silly superstitions and those rituals. They're not harmless. They are harming Buddhism. They're harming these beautiful teachings by covering them up with so many layers that people can't see the heart of it. Even when I'm going to slam Thailand again now. This is even my own monastery, Ajahn Chah's monastery. When I wanted to actually to find out what the Buddha actually taught, are there any copies of the sutras, original Buddhist teachings? Yes, there were in the monastery. They were locked up in a cabinet. They were worshipped but never read. And even recently, maybe someone listening in Thailand could actually do something about this. There was a recent, not translation, but an edition in Roman script done by the Thais at the, I think it's called the Fifth Council. This is not done by the Burmese. The Thais did a much better version. And it was printed in Thailand. We tried to get a copy because as many of our monks here in Serpentine know Pali, and we do a lot of work. You know, just in translations. If you read the copy of the middle-length sayings by Bhikkhu Bodhi or the Sanyutta Nikaya, you'll find my name in the front there, helping out with some of the translations, and many other monks as well. We actually do something with these books, but we couldn't get a copy. They were sent to universities and other monasteries where, to this day, they're put in cabinets. They're never taken out. They're just worshipped rather than read. Is that what we should be doing with Dhamma? So as good monks, we can't even get copies of those things. Or you go to sort of, you know, the Temple of the Tooth. You can't even see that tooth relic if it's there at all. Sometimes that the superstitions which we have in our religions, they stop the truth really happening. And it's not just harmless. It just harms us really finding out the wonderful, beautiful things. Like, as I said today, forgiveness. You make your own heaven and hell. You take responsibility for your actions. If you want to pass the examinations, forget about, you know, taking some incense and, you know, lighting candles and putting donations in the box. That's bribery. Well, you know, asking sort of God, can you imagine, have you ever tried giving a call to, you know, let's say to like to Telstra and getting through to Telstra? We've got some problem with your phone. And what happens? I'm sorry, all our operators are busy. Your call is valuable to us. Imagine trying to pray to God. I'm sorry, all our operators are busy. There's only one of me here. But your call is valuable to me. I'll try and get back to you later on. So, please don't be superstitious. Be rational. Be skeptical. Find out from your own experience. Otherwise, that we'll just become these stupid human beings and we'll just kill our own civilization. We can't sort of pray to somebody else, please Buddha, please stop global warming. No, that this is in God's plan or Buddha's plan or something. You've got to do something about this. Otherwise, it's all going to go wrong. So, don't be superstitious. And that's the talk this evening.
Dance, 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 dance Bodang bagavantang abhivade. Te panno bhagavato savaka sangho sangha namami.